Okay, class. So welcome back to donations. We have been discussing forced airship, and the last thing in your notes at this point should be a discussion of reduction. So that brings us to pretty much the last topic we're going to discuss in connection with forced airship, and that is disinherison. So first of all, I guess the idea of disinherison is that if a decedent has cause to and properly does, in fact, disinherit the forced heir, then the rules of forced heirship are not going to apply, and that then, of course, would mean that the decedent has the power to dispose of all of his property how he sees fit, assuming there's only one forced heir, of course. If you'd like a point of reference, Louisiana Civil Code Article 1494 and 1617 essentially set up the proposition I just stated. Okay, so basically you are going to have a forced heir for disinherison to even come into play. And if you remember from our discussion of forced heirship, both children and grandchildren can be forced heirs. So a parent or a grandparent is allowed to disinherit the forced heir. So basically, you can't just disinherit someone, or a forced heir, that is, at will, not just because you want to. According to Article 1619, the disinherison must be made for just cause. Otherwise, it's going to be null. And furthermore, you as the decedent testator do not get to decide what cause just cause is. According to Article 1620, there are no just causes for disinherison except those expressly recognized in the code. So just remember that if you have a forced heir and you would like to disinherit them, you can't just do it willy-nilly, and you have to have cause to do so, and it must be one of the causes enumerated in the code. So what are those causes? These can be found in Article 1621 and 1622. Now, Article 1621 deals with a parent's causes to disinherit a child, and 1622 deals with a grandparent's causes to disinherit a grandchild. So we'll do the parent first. Basically, there's just this nice long laundry list of eight different reasons. The first is that the child, the forced heir child, that is, of course, raised their hand to strike or actually struck the parent. Now, the comments do go on to say that it is not enough just to threaten to strike a parent, but that the forced heir child must actually strike or raise their hand to strike the parent. The second just cause for disinheriting a forced heir by a parent is if the child is guilty of cruelty, crimes, or grievous injury towards the parent. Typically, we think of cruelty as being some sort of physical action toward the parent. Crime, pretty self-explanatory. And then finally, grievous injury, we tend to think of that as being some sort of psychological damage that the child has inflicted upon the parent. That's reason two. Reason three is that the child, forced heir, of course, still, attempted to kill the parent. Fourth, that the child, forced heir, accused the parent of committing a crime that carries either a death sentence or life in prison sentence without any sort of reasonable basis for that accusation. Reason five, that a parent can disinherit their forced heir child, is the child used any sort of violence or coercion to prevent the parent from making a testament. Reason number six, that a parent can disinherit a child forced heir, is if the child is a minor and married without their parents' consent. You may be asking yourself at this point, you know, how could anyone ever get married if they're a minor without their parents' consent? Although parental consent is typically required under Louisiana law, there may be some exceptions to that with judicial approval, Or it may be that, you know, someone marries a child without any sort of proof of their age of majority. And if that happens, just so you know, the marriage is still valid. It's just that the person, the official who performed the marriage ceremony will get in trouble and be levied some sort of fine. So back to the list. So that was reason number six, that a parent can disinherit a forced heir child. Again, the child gets married as a minor without the parent's consent. Reason number seven would be that the child is convicted of a crime that carries with it a life in prison sentence or a death sentence. And then reason number eight that actually generates some confusion and interesting jurisprudence is that the child is a major, knows how to contact his or her parent, but fails to communicate with the parent without just cause for 2 years, unless that child is in the active U.S. military forces. So, child is a major, knows how to contact the parent, but doesn't do so without just cause for 2 years unless he or she is in the military. Now, we're going to come back in just a second and talk about a couple of cases dealing with reason number eight under Article 1621 that a parent has to disinherit a forced heir child. Now, if you have the situation where a grandchild is a forced heir, again, remember that that happens via representation if they have a predeceased parent and if the grandchild is either disabled or if their predeceased parent, had they lived to the time of the testator slash decedent's death, would still be under the age of 24. Okay, so when you have a grandparent who would like to disinherit a grandchild, he or she can do so for any of the reasons that we mentioned in connection with a parent disinheriting their child, except reason number six, which was the marriage of the child as a minor without parental consent. That's the only one that doesn't apply when you're talking about a grandchild being disinherited as a forced heir by their grandparent. Note two, one other interesting thing about the grandparents being allowed to disinherit their grandchildren is that they can do so if the grandchild committed any of the actions, you know, except number two, which doesn't apply at all, but towards their parent or their grandparent. So just keep that in mind. So with that all said, there's a hypothetical that I have placed in the reading list and hypos to kind of deal with some of the reasons for disinheritance. And that's hypothetical 48. After we do the hypothetical, we'll come back and look at two cases. So hypothetical 48 says that Gwen and Gavin were in an accident in which Gavin was killed and Gwen paralyzed. Gwen went to live with her son, Kingston, who was angry at his mom at the time of the accident. Kingston treated his mom badly, cursing her, leaving her to lie in bed in her own feces, spraying her with Lysol, and giving her very little to eat. Eventually, Gwen's sister rescued her, and Gwen promptly disinherited Kingston. Assuming she did so in proper form, did she have us to do this? Why or why not? Yes, the answer is yes, that Gwen has cause to do so. The most obvious, I guess, reason would be that Kingston would be guilty of grievous injury, cruelty, and crimes. You may could find that others apply as well, but that, of course, is just the most obvious. Okay, so I had assigned you guys to read two different cases, both of which deal with reason eight for disinheriting a child after attaining the age of majority and knowing how to contact a parent has failed to communicate without just cause for a period of 2 years unless the child was on active duty in any of the military forces of the United States. So the first case I want to talk about in connection with that particular call cause for disinheritance is succession of birth toe. Now, this is a case from the First Circuit from 1990. And in this case, we had a guy named Shelley Bertot who died, testate, of course. He had had two sons with a woman named Antoinette, and they're the two kids at issue in this case, and they're both forced heirs under the law at the time. One was Shelley Morris Bartow, and the other was Peter Joseph Bartow. Now, Shelley, the dad, left the family, his wife Antoinette and their two children, actually before the second child, Peter, was even born. He met another woman and told that woman, you know, I'll marry you as soon as I get a divorce from my wife. And, you know, interestingly, he divorced his wife, Antoinette, at 2 p.m. on one day and married the second woman, whose name was Etta, just FYI, at 5 o'clock the same day. He and Etta went on to have two daughters. As time went on, Shelley, the dad, ended up getting arrested for not paying child support for his sons, Shelley and Peter, by his first marriage. He then ended up paying something like $25 a month for the kids. So his relationship, needless to say, with those two boys was probably a little strained. In fact, the oldest son, Shelley the son, only saw his dad twice during his life. It was, you know, something like 50 years, once when he was like 10 years old and once when he was 18, for a total of about 2 hours. The youngest son, in his 48 years, saw his dad 7 times, but the last time he had done so was in 1979, 8 years before Father Shelley died. And, you know, the court does mention that, you know, most of his interactions with his two sons were initiated by other people. So the provision at issue in the testament, of course, is that Shelley the dad disinherited these two forced heir sons, and the just cause that he gives is the failure to communicate. And in this case, he alleges that his sons have not communicated with him for 6 years. There are two issues essentially in the case. One deals with the form of the disinheritance, and the other deals with whether or not Dad Shelley had just cause to disinherit his two sons. Essentially, the First Circuit says that this disinheritance is no good. So the first issue I said, of course, was the form. One of the arguments that the forced heir sons make is that in their dad's testament, he said he was disinheriting them under Article 1623, subsection 12. Well, that provision did not exist. Court says, you know, that's okay. That's obviously just a typo, that it was Article 1621. And so they're like, you know, this disinheritance is just fine on grounds of form, because it clearly states the substance of why the dad is disinheriting the sons. The sons also, in their form argument, go on to argue that their dad's testament fails to say that they didn't communicate with him without just cause, because in the provision, in the testament, it just says they didn't communicate with me for 6 years. And so they're making the argument, oh, well, he didn't write the words just cause in his testament, so that should invalidate the disinheritance. The court said, no, that's fine. He doesn't have to specifically say just cause. We don't need some sort of magic language here. So the court's fine with the form that the dad used to disinherit the kids. So then the question becomes, does he or does he not have just cause to disinherit the children? Basically, the court rules that the dad does not have just cause, okay? Remember that the dad was referring to the provision that says that basically a reason for disinheritance would be if the child is a major, knows how to contact their parent, but fails to communicate without just cause for 2 years unless the child isn't active duty of the military, okay? So The argument or the whole thing that this is going to hinge on is whether or not the kids were justified in not communicating with their father. There's no dispute that they are majors, they're not in the military, and they did, in fact, fail to communicate with their dad for 2 years. But the question is, was their failure to communicate justified? Did they have just cause not to communicate with their dad? The court rules that the kids, these four stayers, did in fact have cause not to communicate with their dad. They looked at some commentators' scholarly writings, Professor Catherine Spate from LSU, and, you know, they said, oh, just cause would include not knowing how to get in touch with the dad or being in the active military. So they're like, that doesn't apply. They knew how to get in touch with him, and they weren't in the military. So the idea is, what kind of duty does a child have to communicate? And under what circumstances could they be excused from doing so besides the lack of knowledge or the military exception? Well, the court says that the duty is definitely on the child to communicate with the parent. So even if you have a big blow-up with your parent and there is some sort of strained relations as a result, that doesn't give you an excuse not to communicate with your parent. So the duty is on you as the forced heir to communicate with your parent. If you do have some big blow-up, the court says, in this case at least, that you don't have to apologize, but you do have to communicate, and you have to do so in a respectful fashion. So, but here, you know, if you stop the analysis there, then these children are out of luck because, you know, they have not communicated with their father. They've not initiated conversation or anything for a long time. But the court sort of carves out a prudential exception because the court goes on to say that, you know, Mr. Berto never had or never sought to establish any relationship with his children. The majority of his contact with them was initiated by other people. And so even though, generally speaking, the duty is on the child to communicate, this court carves out an exception saying that the child does not have to attempt to communicate with the parent when doing so would be futile. If it would be futile to try to communicate with your parent, then you have just cause for your failure to do so. So in this case, they're like, you know, even if these kids had tried to get in touch with their dad, it would have been futile for them to do so. So even though they did not contact him for over 2 years, they weren't in the military, they knew how to get in touch with him, they were a major, the court finds that because it would have been futile, they had just cause for their failure to communicate. So that was the Berto case. Another case dealing with that same provision of Civil Code Article 1621 is the Succession of Gray case. Now, this is from the Third Circuit, 1999. And in this case, we had a guy named Ernest Gray who died in 1994. He died testate, of course. And in his testament, he disinherited his two daughters, Pamela and Michelle, again, for their failure to communicate with him without just cause for 2 years, knowing how to get in touch with him, not being in the military, and their majors. So basically, what happened between this guy and his daughters is a little different from the Berto case. There had been a relationship at one point in time between the decedent and the girls, but in recent years, this guy had attempted four different times to prove that their mother was incompetent. And in 1989, he ended up moving away, and it was at this point that things started to get pretty bad. But there was some evidence, at least, that the daughters had either spoken with him or tried to speak with him. For example, one of the daughters, Pamela, had stopped on a road and talked with him one day, and also had seen him at the post office and the grocery store, all of which was corroborated. Both daughters had actually visited him in 1993, but he refused to speak with them. And then other attempts of theirs to get in touch with their dad were rebuked by their father. So The court has to decide essentially if these girls have in fact failed to communicate with their father for 2 years, and if so, whether they had just cause in doing so. So one thing that was an issue is whether or not what they had done would be enough to satisfy the communication prong of all of this. Is one or two instances of communication enough? And the trial court had said, no, that's not enough to constitute communication. But the appellate court disagreed and said, you know, one or two instances is enough. And the Third Circuit appellate court pointed to a couple of other cases. Interestingly, one was called Succession of Steckler, and in that case, a court had ruled that sending two Christmas cards and a birthday card would be enough to satisfy the communication prong. And then another case was Succession of Groose, which said that if you prepare and deliver a homemade casserole to your parent, that would be enough to constitute communication. And it's okay if your parent doesn't respond. You've done your part in initiating contact. So the court's like, hey, look, we do find that one or two instances, if proven, will be enough to constitute communication. But in this case, the court finds that the girls, Pamela and Michelle, did not carry their burden to show that these communications were within 2 years because of the sparse testimony present in the case. I think I would tend to disagree based on my reading of the case that they didn't carry their burden. Finally, the girls tried to argue that they had just cause in the event that they didn't communicate or that the 2 years had passed, that they had just cause because they said it would be futile to contact their dad. They, in fact, point out that they tried to get in touch with their dad, but that he had rebuffed them, and they pointed to the Berto case in support. The court says, look, you know, we can distinguish Berto. Berto was a much more extreme set of facts here than we have here. In Berto, the dad never had anything to do with these kids and, in fact, had left the family before the second child was even born. Unlike that, in this case, the dad had once had a decent relationship with the girls. And the court says, you know, although they had a strained relationship towards the end of his life, it would not have been futile for these girls to get in touch with their dad, and the burden is on them to maintain the relationship, and they did not. So the court finds, ultimately, that the disinheritance is valid and that these girls are just out of luck. So that wraps up our discussion of what disinheritance is and who plays a part in disinheritance and the fact that you need cause, and it's more specifically cause listed in the code, and we've also gone through what those causes are. Now we need to switch gears for just a second and talk about the form required to disinherit someone. You can find the relevant articles 1618, 1619, and 1624, first sentence, in fact. So what do you need to do to validly disinherit someone, assuming you have cause and that they're at least a presumptive, or that they're a forced heir at the time of your death? Well, first of all, you have to make sure that your disinheritance is in the form or the same form that would be appropriate for a testament. Now, I know that we've not learned about form for testaments yet, and we're going to get into much more detail on that later this semester. But for now, it's enough for you to know that, again, the disinheritance has to be in a form that would be sufficient for a testament. There are two forms that would be sufficient for a testament. One is an holographic form. Just FYI, that would be a document written, signed, and dated in the hand of the testator. Or the second form that would be sufficient for a testament is notarial, which would be an authentic act, and it, If you don't know what that is, an authentic act is where you have a notary and two witnesses. Okay, so that's the first form requirement. It has to be in the form of that would be sufficient for a testament. The second thing that has to be satisfied for your form to be good is that you have to expressly disinherit someone. Now, you don't need magic words like I disinherit, but you need something expressly signifying that you don't want this person to get anything from your estate. The third thing that sort of is a nice segue there, you have to either name the person or somehow identify him or her. And then finally, you can't just say, I disinherit for cruelty. You need to, per Article 1624, give, all the facts and circumstances supporting that cause. So I would encourage you, when you're in your practice, to give as much detail as possible if you're drafting a disinheritance for either a parent or grandparent to cut out their forced heirs. So looking at Hypo 49, this hypo should illustrate those concepts that you need a form sufficient for a testament. It must be expressed. You have to name or identify the person and that you need to include facts and circumstances. So Hypo 49 says, Bobby and Marissa have been very upset with son Bobby Jr., who also goes by the name T-Bob, for his behavior lately. First, T-Bob ran off and married a girl when he was only 16, breaking Marissa's heart. Then, when Marissa yelled at T-Bob for his stupidity, he raised his arm and threatened to bitch slap Marissa. Marissa, in response, executes an act in proper form, meaning it was either holographic or an authentic act that says, I'm so upset with T-Bob, I don't want him to get anything from me since he's been so awful lately. Will this act suffice to disinherit T-Bob? Why or why not? Well, I would say probably not, okay? Marissa does have just cause. If this is kind of a nice little review from our earlier discussion. If you remember, T-Bob is a minor, and he married without parental consent, so that would be just cause under Article 1621. And then it also appears that he raised his hand to strike his mother, which would also be just cause. So we've got reason. So now we need to look at the form. So the facts tell you that you've got either holographic or authentic acts, so that's fine. The next issue, though, is was Marissa express? I mean, she didn't say, I disinherit. But I would argue that, you don't need that magic word, disinherit, and that it's pretty clear by what she has said. I don't want him to get anything from me. I think it's pretty clear that she is trying to disinherit him. So I'd say the express prong is satisfied. Next issue, did she properly identify him? I'd say yes. I mean, even though this was a nickname, she used T-Bob, not Bobby Jr. If everyone knew him by that name, especially, I would think that this would just fine. The problem, though, is that all Marissa says is he's been so very awful lately. She doesn't include any of the facts, reasons, or circumstances for why she's disinheriting T-Bob, so I think that would be fatal to this disinheritance and would make it invalid. All right, so next topic in connection with disinheritance is when do you disinherit someone? You can look at Article 1621 Provision B and Article 1623 to find the answer. Basically, whatever the forced heir has done to get himself disinherited must have happened before the ascendant, parent or grandparent, executes the instrument disinheriting that forced heir. And then something that I should point out is that someone can be disinherited even if he or she is not a presumptive forced heir when she does the act in question. So, for example, if if my son was not 14 but was 24, for example, and he was perfectly healthy and fine, if he slapped me across the face, okay, so at that moment it happened, he wasn't a presumptive force heir. He wasn't going to be a force heir if I die the next, you know, the next instant. But I could still sit down and execute a disinheritance. Now, why would you want to do that? It's important that if you have just cause to disinherit a child or a grandchild, even if they're not a force heir right then, go ahead and disinherit them, because if you recall, because of the definition of who is a forced heir under current Louisiana law, it's possible that you could have a child who could become a forced heir down the road before you die. So between the time they do something awful and the time that you die, they could become forced heir, even if at the time that they did that something awful, they weren't. Hypothetical 50 illustrates that concept. It says, Sunday Rose, age 26, shoots her mom, Nicole, apparently in an attempt to kill her. Nicole immediately draws up a document in proper form in which she purports to disinherit Sunday Rose on the grounds of cruel treatment, crime, or grievous injury and attempt on Nicole's life. Weeks later, Sunday Rose is in a car accident in which she is paralyzed and suffers brain damage, rendering her incapable of caring for herself or her property. 2 weeks later, Nicole dies. Keith, Nicole's spouse, seeks to enforce the act of disinheritance. Sunday Rose's representative argues that when Nicole executed the disinheritance and when Sunday Rose shot her mom, Sunday Rose was not a presumptive heir, forced heir, because she was over 24 and not disabled. Do you think Nicole's disinheritance will stand? Why or why not? The answer is yes. Although Sunday Rose was not a forced heir when she shot Nicole, or in fact when Nicole executed the act of disinheritance, the code will allow Nicole to disinherit anyway, and it's a good thing that she did, because before her, Nicole's death, Sunday Rose became a forced heir via incapacity. All right, so now you know the idea of it, of disinheritance, you know, what will get a forced heir disinherited, you know the form you need to satisfy, and you know the timing. The next thing is we need to talk about burden of proof, okay? You can find the relevant article, Article 1624. And basically what you learn from that article is that when you're looking at the act of disinheritance, what the testator or decedent has written down, whatever they say happened in regard to this purported cause for disinheritance, whatever the decedent says happened is presumed to be true. So therefore, when you have a presumption, the other party, in this case the one who's been disinherited or the forced heir, bears the burden of proof that the cause for disinheritance or all those facts given is not true. And the disinherited one, who, like I said, bears the burden of proof, has to prove that these facts are not true by a preponderance of the evidence. And the testimony in question must also be corroborated with other evidence. There was a case that I assigned you guys discussing the burden of proof on the disinheritance itself, and it was Succession of Vincent. This is a Louisiana Supreme Court case from 1988. In it, we had a guy named Joseph Vincent who died state, of course, and in his will, he tried to disinherit his son, Paul Roy. The ground that Joseph mentions is that Paul Roy hit him 3 times and fired at him with a .22. Allegedly, according to Joseph, Joseph, filed an offense report with Deputy Dewey Hebert, and that all of the facts in question were witnessed by a guy named William Poole. Now, Paul Roy, of course, is going to deny all this. And he is going to bring forth testimony to try to rebut the presumption that the facts of this disinheritance are true, because, of course, he wants the disinheritance provision to fail. So he brings forth testimony of Joseph's wife, who I would presume would be his mother, who says that she did not even know about the incident until 1984 when Joseph made his will. All she could really testify is that the father and son argued a lot and that they were loud and violent. Other testimony presented in the case was that of Joseph Benson's daughter. All she testified is that there was a bad relationship between the father and son. I think important testimony here is that of William Poole. Poole testified that he and Mr. Joseph Vincent were working at Joseph's camp, and that Joseph had allowed Paul Roy to live at the camp with his wife and kids, and that Paul Roy had come home, gone fishing, and was going into the camp to go to sleep when Joseph asked Paul Roy, hey, you know, why can't you keep this place clean? The two began to argue, things got physical, and according to Poole, Paul Roy tried to hit Joseph, but Poole admitted that he couldn't say with all certainty who threw the first punch. He did say that Joseph hit Paul Roy with a stick, and Paul Roy got a gun. Poole yelled at him to put down the rifle, but that he never heard any shots, but he did say, you know, look, like 150 feet away from them, next to a dump truck that had the engine running, had no muffler. Joseph said he called the police and that Dewey Hebert handcuffed Paul Roy and took away his rifle. Of course, Paul Roy is going to testify that, you know, that this is not the way things happen. First of all, he denies that Poole was even there. And then he goes on to deny striking his father, and he said that, in fact, Father Joseph hit him from behind after he told him, look, I'll clean up after I get some sleep. Paul Roy also said that he got the weapon out for self-defense and that he never tried to shoot his dad. And he said Deputy Hebert did not arrest him and that no charges were ever filed. Now, I will say there was no evidence of charges presented in the case. I think also interesting testimony here was Paul Roy's wife, who was sitting on the front porch the whole time that this happened but did not testify. Now, the trial court believed Mr. Poole and not Paul Roy, and the appellate court essentially affirmed. They found the disinheritance to be valid. The whole basis for their ruling was the burden of proof, that there is a rebuttable presumption that the facts in the will about the alleged cause for disinheritance are true, and that the disinherited one bears the burden of proving that they are not. And that in this case, Paul Roy did not overcome the presumption, and he did not carry his burden. All he's got, essentially, is his own testimony. And that wraps up our discussion of the burden of proof on the acts surrounding the reason for the disinheritance. Now, I should say this. Even if the acts surrounding the disinheritance are true, and the disinherited person cannot come up and satisfy his burden of proof by preponderance that the facts are not true, he still may have a way out. And that is because there are affirmative defenses to disinheritance. You can find those in Article 1625 and 1626. Essentially, there are four defenses to disinheritance. So even if you did something awful and you're a forced heir and you did this to your parent or your grandparent and they disinherit you and they do it in the right form and everything's good to go, you can still avoid being disinherited if you can show one of these four defenses. We're going to go through each of the four separately, and then we'll look at a hypothetical that illustrates them. All right, so the first defense to disinheritance is reconciliation. Now, this term isn't defined in the article or the comments, but we tend to think that reconciliation is a bilateral action where the parent or grandparent forgives the forced heir and then the two of them actually try to work on fixing their broken relationship. Now, in the event that you're a forced heir and you get disinherited and the reasoning is all true, if you want to argue that, wait a minute, okay, I did those things, it's true, my dad or whoever sat down and did execute a valid inheritance of me, but hey, wait just a second. We made up after he did that, and he just never went back and undid his inheritance. Well, if you're going to make that argument, you should know that you don't have to have any sort of proof in writing that your parent or grandparent did, in fact, reconcile with you. Now, if you have a writing, that certainly will suffice for your reconciliation, but you don't have to have a writing. But you, the person disinherited, you do bear the burden of proof. It's an affirmative defense. Of course you do. And you have to prove this by clear and convincing evidence. So remember, you know, if you're trying to dispute the facts surrounding the disinheritance, you bear the burden of proof, but it's only by a preponderance. If you're trying to assert, yeah, I got disinherited and the reasons were there, but we made up later, you still have the burden of proof, but your burden is higher in that it's clear and convincing. So that was your first potential affirmative defense. The second one is that because of your age or mental condition, you were not capable of understanding the impropriety of what you did. Again, this is an affirmative defense, so you bear the burden of proof. But unlike reconciliation, your standard is only preponderance of the evidence. Your third affirmative defense to being inherited is that you lacked intent to do whatever action you were guilty that got you disinherited. Again, affirmative defense, so you bear the burden of proof, and like incapacity, the burden is preponderance. Final affirmative defense, if you're a disinherited forced heir, is that, yes, I did those actions, question, but they were justified. If you assert justification as an affirmative defense, you, the one who's been disinherited, does bear the burden of proof. However, the burden is only preponderance. So looking at hypothetical 51, this should illustrate these affirmative defenses. It says, a few weeks before she died, some bad things happened between Angelina on the one hand and her three kids on the other. First, Maddox, 25 years old and a paraplegic with the mental age of 4, ran over Angelina with his wheelchair. Pax, who's 23 and epileptic, ran over to help Angelina, but he had a seizure which caused him to blow Angelina in the face. As Angelina staggered blindly, she almost staggered into the street where a car was quickly approaching. Zahara, age 20, tackled Angelina to save her from the oncoming car. Angelina draws up an act of disinheritance in proper form in which she disinherits these three children by name and details the facts surrounding that day, as she called it. After Angelina died, her brother James, who will inherit if the children are disinherited, sought to have the act enforced. If the children challenged the inheritance, who bears the burden of proof on it, and what is the standard? Do the children have defenses, and if so, what are they? Okay. If they try to challenge the disinheritance itself, the children would bear the burden of proof because it is presumed that the facts surrounding the just cause as Angelina detailed them, they're presumed to be true. So the children would bear the burden of proof, and their standard would be preponderance of the evidence. But the question then goes on to ask, do the children have any defenses, and were they? Maddox could argue that he lacked capacity, that because of his mental capacity, he was incapable of understanding the impropriety of his behavior. Pax could argue that his action was unintentional, and Zahara could argue that she was justified in what she did. If the children assert these defenses, who bear the burden of proof, and what will be the standard? The children will bear the burden of proof, and their burden on all of the defenses previously mentioned, lack of capacity, lack of intent, and justification, would be preponderance. The hypo goes on to ask, would your answer as to the burden of proof on defenses change if the children argued that after the events of that day they made up with their mother? The answer there is yes. they would still bear the burden of proof because it's still an affirmative defense, but their standard would now be elevated to clear and convinced. All right, so that wraps up the defenses to disinheritance. The last thing we need to talk about with regard to disinheritance itself is what's the effect. The article that you can look at that gives you the answer is Article 1500. Basically, when the forced heir gets disinherited and, you know, you have the just cause and it's done in proper form, it's expressed, they're listed a name, all the facts and circumstances are detailed, everything's good to go. When this happens, basically the forced heir's legitime becomes disposable. So you add it back to the disposable portion. By the way, that same rule would apply if a forced heir renounced or is declared worthy. So in order to really understand that concept of we take forced heir's legitime, the disinherited forced heir's legitime, and add it back to the disposable portion, you can look at Hypos 52 and 53. Hypo 52 says, Tim and Leslie have two children, Maggie and Jake, both of whom are forced heirs. After Maggie shoots Leslie disinherits Maggie in proper substance and form. The question asks, what are the forced portion and disposable portions before the disinheritance? What were the legitimes? And then what happens after Maggie is validly disinherited? Okay, so before the disinheritance, you had two forced roots, Maggie and Jake. So therefore, the forced portion would be one half, and the disposable would be one half as well. Then you have to take the one-half forced portion and look at the two forced heirs' legitime, because there are two roots there. Each would get half of that half. So Maggie and Jake each are entitled under forced heirship law to one-fourth Leslie's property. After the disinheritance, what you do is you take Maggie's one-fourth legitime and add it back to the disposable portion. So, in essence, the disposable portion was originally one-half, and then when you add Maggie's one-fourth, the disposable portion is now three-fourths, and then Jake's legitime is not affected at all. He still walks away with his one-fourth. Similarly, Hypo 53, we still have Tim and Leslie, but now they have three kids, Maggie, Kelly, and Jake, and they're all forced heirs. Same thing, Maggie shoots Leslie, Leslie disinherits Maggie. We want to know what happens to the forced and disposable portion, okay? So before the disinheritance, you had three forced heirs or forced heir roots, so the forced portion would be half. And then each forced heir, Maggie, Kelly, and Jake, they would have a legitime of one-third of that one-half. So each of them would be entitled to a legitime of one-sixth of her total, her being Leslie, total property. And then you would have a half as the disposable portion. After Maggie's disinherited, we return Maggie's one-sixth to the disposable portion. So, in essence, what you've got is the original disposable portion, which was a half, and then add back to that Maggie's one-sixth, which would equal to two-thirds as the final number for the disposable portion. And then Kelly and Jake would each still have their respective one-sixth. Now, that wraps up our discussion of disinheritance, but there is one last thing that I do need to talk about, and this is not, this doesn't have to do just with disinheritance. This is just a concept that is tested on the bar with regard to forced heirship. I don't believe it's even in your reading list and hypos, but it does pop up a lot on the bar, and so I wanted to make sure that I explained it to you at least briefly. And that deals with what happens where you may have a person who doesn't live in Louisiana, but they have property in Louisiana. Will forced heirship laws apply to that piece of property? And also, what happens if you have someone who does live in Louisiana when they die, but they have a piece of property outside of the state of Louisiana? will forced heirship apply to that property? So in essence, what we're doing here is learning some conflicts rules when it comes to successions and forced heirship. So let me tell you, first of all, that as a general rule, like not even talking about forced heirship at all, but a general rule, if you have a decedent who has movable property, then what happens to that property is going to be governed by the law of the state where the decedent was domiciled to death. If, on the other hand, what you're talking about is immovable property, as a general rule, that property is governed by the law of the state where immovable is located. That's called law of the situs. Now, there are two exceptions under Louisiana conflicts provisions dealing only with immovable property and only dealing with forced heirship law. So basically, let's look at that first situation I mentioned a minute ago. Let's say we've got a decedent and he has immovables in Louisiana. The laws of forced heirship, the only time they won't apply to immovables located in Louisiana is if our decedent is domiciled somewhere else, not in Louisiana, and decedent does not have any forced heirs domiciled in Louisiana. Okay? So, again, you have a dead guy. He's got immovable property in Louisiana. Forced heirship law will apply unless the decedent was domiciled elsewhere and he has no forced heirs in Louisiana. Okay, so forced heirship laws do not apply to immovables located in Louisiana if the decedent is domiciled somewhere else and has no forced heirs domiciled in Louisiana. The second situation deals with immovables outside of Louisiana. And the question is, okay, when will Louisiana law, more specifically forced heirship law, apply to immovable property located outside of Louisiana? Forced heirship law will apply to that property outside of Louisiana if the decedent was domiciled in Louisiana and the decedent left a forced heir domiciled in Louisiana. So that wraps up what I needed to tell you guys about disinheritance and the conflicts provisions for forced heirship. I encourage you that if any questions about this lecture or anything for that matter, don't hesitate to shoot me an email, give me a call, or come by office during office hours. And I hope this wasn't too extremely painful. Have a good day, and I'll see you next class. Bye.